Accession number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, Reel 5.
Mr. George S. Richardson, Reel 5. You said you were drawing plans, Mr. Richardson. What use was made of them?
They were for the company commanders to have a view of where all the billets were in each of the places of where all billeted around all the villages around that area. The first ones, of course, were plans of just the seafront, with all the companies arranged along the seafront from Swanage right along to the length of our front, with the battalion headquarters and our company headquarters back in Lytton Cheney. And of course in Lytton Cheney, besides Defence Company, we also had a company of, I think it was A Company, I'm not sure.
You said that you were billeted in a barn, like I said, didn't you?
Our cookhouse, our dining room, was in the barn. The nappy was right, or our little nappy was right next to it. And we had no toilet facilities except for any near the close headquarters of the...
Were these a temporary toilet facility?
There was no toilet facility, except for the temporary toilet facilities where the companies were billeted.
Where were the companies, the fighting companies, billeted?
Well, they were all along the safe front. Of course, they were tended and dug in during the expected invasion. And in behind the safe front, mostly in old farm buildings right along the free front, because there wasn't many buildings along that area. We mapped the whole of them out, and I was on busy mapping Lytton Cheney out. This was my first trip out with a drawing board, and I was putting in details of the company which was just below the house standing next to where the battalion headquarters was. Our company office was down about 100 yards away in a little old house. I was just starting to etch in the buildings on the tracing to transfer it onto the big map when a sergeant come. Oh, first of all, a woman came out and asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm drawing these billets, it's my job. She said, who's your company commander? And I couldn't tell his name. I'd only seen him once, and nobody had introduced him as being Major Watson. So I said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you why. She says, well, you should know. He lives in this house. So next thing I knew, there's this sergeant come running around, fixed bayonet, and no joke, no one's hot. And... took the board off me and looked at it. He says, oh yes, looks like the right one. And double marched me down to our headquarters, because I told him I was belonged to a headquarter company. He double marched me down to headquarter company. So I went in, and orderly officers at the desk, and sergeant showed him what I had, and he says, oh, he was a fifth colonel, he made a good job, right? Dressed in Terminate infantry battle dress, because well, a little DLI on it. Anyway, Colonel Sergeant Handel was sitting at the desk, and he says, show me your paperwork. So I showed me paperwork, and of course inside the paperwook was also, besides the AB64, there was a paperwork which they wrote down our weekly increments. And he looked at it and opened his file, He said, well, if he's a spy, we're paying him. He says, he's down here, what he says he is. Private Richards in GS 445-8727. So the sergeant went away with it. He was still between his legs. But he was only trying to do his job and no harm doing.
Was there a sensitivity towards Fifth Column and parachutists at this
point? Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, once or twice I went out with, usually went out with pairs, more or less at night time, to certain lanes, just to see if it's seeing anything. I remember going along, it was a fairly brightish night, not full moon, but brightish moonlight, and I saw these lights on the side. I hadn't seen anything like it before. So, it says, hey, somebody having a smoke in there. So we pulled up and crept back. There were flies, what they call them? Glow flies. And there were tons of them. And they're playing around there, and I thought there was somebody sitting there having a smoke. That's how sensitive we were to. And of course, anything that appertained to aircraft coming down, well, mainly we dispatched anybody to look after them.
You moved on from Dorset into Devon. About what time would this be?
Well, I think it must have been in November. It was before Christmas. Before that, we were all given the chance of a leave. We had the chance of a 48-hour leave, but most of us belonged to Durham, and we had no chance of getting up to Durham and back in 48 hours, the way the railways were then. So I chose to go to my sister's in Surrey. She lived in Caterham, and I put in for the pass and got it, and set off on the Friday, and after duties Friday night, and travelled over to London, and then from London up to Croydon, from Croydon, found my way to Caterham. And this was, I thought, and there was areas going off all the time, and keep stopping. And I think this is sometimes Saturday afternoon. And as I was crossing over Caterham Common, I found my sister coming across with my younger sister that you've just met. Not the youngest one, the one from America. And my elder sister Elsie, who's now passed away. And they were coming with her sister-in-law, wheeling prams, loaded up with goods. She had been bombed out. Not my sister, her sister-in-law had been bombed out. And they're moving over to, Elsie's husband, friend's mother's, somewhere like that. Anyway, when she met me, she took me back to her house and let them carry on with what they were doing. And there was areas continuously more or less where we were there. Sunday morning came, and the Arid sirens went, and there were dogfights going overhead. We were in our Anderson shelter, and the Anderson shelter was just down the garden, all in a row, next door to each other. I saw a parachutist coming down. Didn't know whether it was an enemy or a Royal Air Force. I had my rifle, and I put one at the spout, and watching up, when I heard this sudden swishing noise, because I was telling my sisters that I'm going to catch a German prisoner of war. Just as then I heard a big swish, I lunged into the shelter, pushed my younger sister, what's in there now, on top of my other sister, and their two small children into the arid shelter. The stick of bombs had come right along the street, and one had landed on the Anderson shelter next to us. When that quietened down, I got out to see what had happened, and found all the damage and quite a lot of screaming going off. And I think there was around about six people had been killed, and one or two more lying around injured. I never saw what happened to the parachutist. He'd come down somewhere else, but not near us. Anyway, Just shortly after, we went into the house. Sister Elsie had been preparing Sunday's lunch, and that was all blasted. The oven was over and dinner was ruined. All the crockery was broken. I heard wardens were coming down and telling people to get out of the houses. There were unexploded bombs in the street. Just then, an RAP, not an RAP, Home Guard, a Home Guard in battle dress with a rifle slung over his shoulder, came and asked me if I would shoot a horse that had its hind legs damaged by the bomb. And I said, well, you've got a rifle, why don't you shoot it? He says, I've got no bullets. So I pulled one out of my pouch and gave him a bullet. He says, I don't know how to use it, I've never fired a rifle before. So I went round over to the next street. This horse was lying on his back legs, badly broken. So I put a shot through its head. Result was, when we had to move out of there, and I didn't have any dinner, I decided that it was best for me to make my way back to barracks, back to Dorset, and we carried on. When I got back, late at night, I reported in the guard room, leave pass, present, and then the next morning I went to the company office and reported that I'd used 1.303 bullet. And they wanted to know how, of course. Of course, everything had to be counted for, as you know. And I explained what had happened, so he says, oh, well, I can safely give you one, and just got one out of the ammunition box and replaced it to make my 200 ration. And that was it. I don't suppose there's any record ever made of that. But it was just one of the little incidents that happened. I think just after that, and that must have been in late October, I don't know, my sister in there might know exactly when, because she was there, but she was just a young girl. We went from there into Devon, and I was still in the intelligence section this time. We moved, first of all, into Ofcombe, and I hadn't been caring much for the work that we were doing in the intelligence section. One or two of them were pushing for promotion. There was only a small section, eight of us. One had already been made up, Tommy Cairns had already been made up to full corporal from corporal, and I was itching to get back in the signals. So I asked to go back in the signal platoon.
What was the basic role of the intelligence section, other than drawing maps?
Well, the intelligence section we used in all kinds of ways, mostly to gather information from around the companies, and also to keep the war diary for the battalion. The intelligence officer kept the war diary for the battalion, and he got the information from his section, and the section had to go out and get basic facts. And of course, we knew where everything was, and the intelligence officer more or less kept the commanding officer informed of everything that was going on. Any rumours that we heard, we just automatically passed on. And of course, if they wanted to spread any funny rumours, it was through us, you see.
Did you remember the name of the intelligence officer?
No, I can't. He hadn't been a Durham Light Infantry officer when he joined us in Lytton Cheney. He was a southerner. I can't remember who he was.
So you moved back into the signal section when you
I
went to Devon?
I moved back into the signal section when we went into Devon, and the signal section were first of all outside of Ofcombe, about in a small village, Willand, about 2 miles out from Ofcombe on the main Exeter, on the main Exeter to Exeter Road, about halfway between Exeter and there's the next place along. There's a halfway house just along there. I joined the signals, and Number 18 wireless sets are being given to the signallers, and our officer, Lieutenant Hulse, had just finished a course on wireless, and he began giving us lectures and talks on the use of radio, telephone and wireless telegraphy.
Can you describe a number 18 set?
Yes, it was big and bulky, a matter of about 22 inches, I would say, high, about 15 inches wide and about 12 inches deep. It had two heavy batteries for its power and about eight different kinds of valves. We had a spare valve box that we had to carry. If a valve went, we had to change it. We learned how to change the batteries, change the valves, general maintenance of a microphone, and it had a Morse key.
What weight would it be?
I would say about 20 pounds, maybe 22 pounds.
And was this designed to carry on your back?
This was on a harness slung on the back. While we carried that, we couldn't carry our small pack. Our small pack, we still had to carry, but that had to be slung on our side. We still had to carry that because that carried our mess tins and our eating materials and any tech rations what we were issued with.
And did you still have a rifle?
I did. We all had a rifle in a single platoon until, I think, in the Middle East, they decided that the NCOs were issued with sidearms. I was given a 3.8 revolver, taken on a course of revolver shooting, and were issued with 24 rounds of .38.
What was the principle of working an 18 set?
It was on the on the back. The aerial we could put up to about 6 foot above the set for normal carrying. We could even extend it more if it was on a vehicle. We have even extended up to something like about 16 feet. One time we had to send a message in Sicily. But basically, it would only transmit and receive in a range of about 3 miles. If the land was clear, if you were in buildings, etc., it was restricted. Later on, they brought another wireless, and I can't tell you which wireless it was, but it was much more compact, smaller, and it had a range of about 6 miles.
If you were in a situation where it wouldn't transmit well or couldn't transmit at all, what throwback did you have?
Well, runners. We were basically the communications of the battalion. We had wireless when we were on the move, and only when we were on the move. Basically, we ran out lines, communicated by field telephone from company to company. We had a 12-line exchange that we transferred company commanders to company commanders and through to the battalion office, the adjutant or the commanding officer, whichever they asked for. There's a telephone going. And that's the general duty of the signals, to keep communications. We had about half a dozen cycle runners we used, even road runners used if the distance wasn't too great, but we had to get the message through one way or the other. We also had visual signalling, such as semaphore and Morse lamp, and when we were abroad in countries like Cyprus, we were able to use the heliograph over a range of about 22 miles from hill to hill, but that was about the farthest that we could, but usually our battalion wasn't stretched out those distances apart.
So where were you billeted, in Ufcombe?
In Ufcombe, we had billeting a very large manor house. I think it's called Lovecombe House. The stables at one end we use for the cuckoos, and there was a large addition, I think, that made the dining rooms. And all the headquarter company could more or less sit down and at one go. Those that weren't on duty. It usually worked out that the company of around about 200 of other ranks were about, usually around about 200 when we were starting. But as soon as we were on the move, the headquarter companies moved out. Of course, the MT sections went to different companies for motor transport. We had two dispatch riders in our platoon, of course, and they were used mostly to carry messages back to brigade headquarters. The roll call signals used to come into our signal office from divisional or brigade with orders and messages, and we usually had to sign for them, put them into the logbook, and carry them into the adjutant's office. They were the written sealed material. The messages, of course, was on the army message pad that we used for messages between companies, and of course when we were static, the adjutant would just ring to our exchange and ask to be put on to Major Ferns, and we would just plug into his company, give a little ring, his company clerk would pick up and say, adjutant to speak to Major Ferns, please, and you're through, sir, and that was it. Very simple operation of the 12 line. And when we were really static for months on end, then we used two 12 lines, because we had to have lines to every little department, such as the carrier section, the MT office, the quartermaster, and all the smaller sections, all had their own telephones. And so we needed about 24 lines instead of 12.
Did you do some manoeuvring activities where you were pretending to be under fire?
Of course. During the time that we were on the Dorset beaches, the range in artillery nearly every day. They were ranging shots from 2 or 3 miles behind us, over the hills. We couldn't see them, over the hills and into the sea in front of our forward companies. They were, first of all, fire smoke shells. They would have an observation post on the front, and they would wireless back in their own with their own signalers back to the gunnery officer, and they'd have a lift range or drop range until they got. And once it opened up, a whole battery would open up on that little spot, so the troops down the front could hear shells whistling there.
You yourself, when you went into Devon, were you involved in manoeuvres and training?
Oh yes. I'd moved into the signal platoon by then in Devon, and we did ordinary route marches of average between 20 and 28 mile at least three times a week with all the rest of the companies. Our officer took out the full platoon, and though only those who were on guard duty or excused duty were excused from the route march. We also did exercises while we were in Devon. We did massive exercises. It was getting into winter, and Dartmoor, Exmoor were over there. Around Dartmoor prison, we were firing mortars, firing rifle practice in the misty November, December time on Dartmoor, and it was cold and dismal, and we sometimes even went down into the officer's canteen, the prison officer's canteen, for a cup of tea. But not very often. We didn't like us mingling with them.
Were you working with other arms of the service, tanks?
Oh yes. Not tanks. We didn't have any direct access for calling on other arms, direct from our single office at that time. It was later on that we did, but at that time we didn't. Royal Corps of Signals did, of course, and whenever we were in action or going into even a large exercise, then a Royal Corps of Signals truck with a wireless set and two operators would come to the battalion headquarters, and he would be in direct communication with Brigadier and COs, so that the any messages that were to be sent direct to the Brigadier or even the Divisional General went through the Royal Corps of Signals. We were there for the sole communications between companies and battalion headquarters.
So you would be getting information before the men got it?
That's right.
So did that mean that you were being prized this information as you went into billets or whatever, asking for it?
Well, yeah, there was in what moves are on, how long are going to be stuck around here? Because it was a nice part of the country in the summer. It was dreary in the winter. And, of course, they asked us, but because we were supposed to be professionals in our job, well, we weren't allowed to talk. I mean, this is one thing that was instilled into us in our training, that information given to us, and all our training manuals, of course, on the first page, was the information in this book is not to be given to persons unauthorised. And
must have been quite difficult, though, at times, with men asking you what you were talking and what was going
but,
on.
Sometimes would get a little whisper, which was going to be a room at the set around, and we were told, don't say too much, but tell. And we knew that was a room that we had to get sent out, propaganda mostly. And we used to do that. But vital information, well, we didn't have much contact with the others except when on guard duty. I mean, we had our own little job, they had their own little job, and then more or less, they kept them, each of their sections, especially in the companies. And it was only when we were actually in battle that we were dispatched to companies to really work with them. On exercises, of course, we were sent with company commanders as their signaller back. And at that time, companies didn't have any communication between platoons. They had their own company runners that ran between platoon officers with their information.
So sent into a company on an exercise as a company commander's signal, and what kind of work was that then?
Well, basically to look after the static telephone, but we were starting to use wireless, and at that time we were in contact, and we changed the frequency every 24 hours, usually 12 noon, and we had also code books, which we could change messages into code and transmit by code on either WTOC or RTOC, wireless telegraphy or radio telegraphy. And the company commander would just say, Corporal, send me this message, and either that or the company runner would come and give us a message from the company commander, and of course it was written out to whoever he wanted to receive from, and his command, and we would just transmit it either by radio, telephone, or WTOC.
In a training exercise, action situation, if the company commander left the headquarters to visit his platoons, did you go with him as a signaller?
Not when we go abroad. Not in training exercises. We were used, according to the training manuals, we weren't really used before we left England to go abroad. We weren't used very much for communications. I don't think company commanders or the commanding officer had much faith in the new form type of signalling. I suppose in the First World War, I'd used mostly signals for runners, and static positions in trenches where they just use telephones or fuller phones, and the signals are just there for that purpose. But not before we wanted, given the job of looking after officers, the way we did when we went abroad. And then once we found out the use of signalers, really, then the company commander used to rely on his signalling, and we used to be trailing along with his company headquarters staff.